Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our new series on, I don't even know the name of the series, the Mystical Key to Relationships or something like that. It's got two great words, mystical and relationships, so you can't go wrong. And what we're going to learn is based on the teachings of Rav Moshe Cordovero, a great Kabbalist who lived in Tzfat in the 1500s, and those who participated in our Milestones of Jewish Philosophy course, which you guys took a couple classes. You were out of town for part of the time. Sandy took a couple. Not all of them. You missed a couple. You were out of town also. But I don't think anybody else. Were you there when I did Cordovero? You don't remember. Because I don't remember.
I was there, but don't ask me any questions.
Good. That's good. Okay. So,
10 years ago in the library.
That's right. So then you know what we're teaching. So you probably can remember it all. Okay. Anyway, there's some more sheets here. So we're going to learn Kabbalah in this series, and we will apply Kabbalah to relationships. And today is an introductory day. So you're really not going to get any, I hate to say the word, useful material. I don't like to say it that way. No, practical examples will be coming in the following weeks. Today we're going to give you the premises upon which it is based, and therefore to make it believable that people can do these things. relationships is a very complex topic, and some people do well in relationships and some people don't. And I would say many people have challenges in relationships, and we probably feel that very strained and challenged to maintain good relationships, especially since we are perfect and all the other people have the problems. And if everybody else was like me and you, then everything would be fine, right? So we're going to talk about some of the understandings of how we can rise to the occasions in relationships, and we're going to start with discussing two or three issues today. And it's all based on the following principle. The following principle is, the Torah says that when God created the first man, he created him b'tzelem Elohim, in the image of God. What you might want to do is use the other side as your note side. The side we have right now, we're not going to look at probably for about a half an hour when we go inside. So if you want to take notes, maybe use the other side. And then I'll tell you when to look on the side with the text. So man was created in God's image. That's a very difficult concept. Why is it a difficult concept? Because the Torah also says, and it's one of the 13 principles of Jewish belief, that God has no image. So only Judaism could tell you that we're in the image of God, and God has no image. So I guess we have no image. Well, it's very hard to understand. So what does that mean? And this was a discussion throughout the generations. Maimonides and others had a big discussion. And really the major breakthrough in terms of relatively contemporary Jewish thinking came with Rav Moshe Cordovero, and we'll get to what he tells us very shortly. But let's begin with another piece in the Torah, the famous story of the sin of the golden calf. This is one of the worst sins the Jewish people collectively did. It's from the top five. Okay, from the top five. And truthfully, the rabbis tell us any sin that ever happens in the history of the Jewish people is all rooted in this sin of the golden calf. And at that point, God, as it were, says to Moshe, I'm going to wipe them out. That's it. After all I did for them, I took them out of Egypt and everything. I did gave them a Torah and everything. And what do? They worship the golden calf. I'm going to wipe them out. And of course, Moshe, the great defender of the Jewish people, he goes on the mountain, he's discussing with God back and forth, arguing back and forth until Hashem says, okay, Salachti kidvarecha, I will forgive them as you have requested. Now, Moshe, being a good defense attorney and knowing to seize the moment, he had a success. So Moshe said, you know what? Now that I got God to listen to me on one thing, you know, I have a whole list of requests that I have from Hashem. And Hashem acquiesced to many of his requests. Finally, Moshe says, okay, God, let me see you. Let me see you. And God says, sorry, you can't see me. No human being can see me and yet live. But if you want, I'll let you get a little peek from the back. Whatever that means. Now, so Moshe could not see Hashem, but he wanted to learn a lot about Hashem. So Hashem agrees and says, listen, Everything you need to know about me, I will show you. I will show you. And then the Talmud tells us the following. The Talmud says that God wrapped himself in a talus as it were. Of course, there was no real talus, but there's an imagery of a talus, like a chazan. And he showed Moshe the order of prayer. I'm quoting the Talmud. And he said to him, anytime the Jewish people sin and they're in trouble, have them perform for me the following arrangement and I will forgive them. And then in the Torah we have the famous words, and you sing it all the time during the High Holidays, Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum, V'chanun, Erech, Apayim, Rav Chesed, V'mes. Right? You know what I'm talking about? Maybe if I sing it. Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum, V'chanun, right? God, God, God of mercy. There are, and that is known as the 13 attributes of divine mercy. That is what God revealed to Moshe. The Talmud tells us it is a very powerful covenant that God made with Moshe that the 13 attributes do not return empty-handed. When you perform the 13 attributes, they do not go back empty-handed. Now, the Maharal tells us something very important. The Gemara doesn't say that God said to Moshe, say the 13 attributes. He didn't say the 13 attributes. He said, perform the 13 attributes. You know, there's no such thing in Judaism. We just say a bunch of words and everything's fine. There's no such thing. No such thing. Even if you say it, you got to know what you're saying. And more important, you have to live it. So if you will do this, God says, if you will do the 13 attributes, you will be forgiven. And this needs explanation. What does this mean? What does it mean you're going to do this? So what's going on over here? What was the whole breakthrough that came over? And this was an amazing thing. And we say it every year, the 13 attributes. In the whole month of Elul, by Slichos, and Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and we just, at Ne'ilah, so many times, Hashem, Hashem, Kel Rachum, Chanun. This is like critical, such a critical thing. So what is it all about? What is it for? How does it help us? How do we have this guarantee that Hashem will forgive us if we perform it? So let's go back to what does it mean to being in God's image? And this is what Cordovero lays down for us. You'll see this will all become very relevant. Just be a little patient. Everybody wants all the fireworks in the first 10 minutes. Got to be a little patient, right? We have a more mature crowd, so we have patient people here, right? And it'll be very fruitful. This is the one thing we have to memorize. There's a difference between what God is and what God does. Okay? Now, what is God? We have no idea. If anybody asks you, what is God? Your answer is, I have no idea. There's no way to describe God. That's what it says. He has no form. There is no image. There's nothing physical about God that we can explain. He's beyond physicality. We only know, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. God is one. And not like any oneness that we know. He is one. We don't know what he is. You can't. It's impossible. That's what God said to Moshe. You can't see me. So what does it help to have a God you don't know who he is? And more than that, the Torah says one of the 613 commandments is Uboz Tidbak, and you will cling to him. You will cleave to him. How can you cleave to any being that you have no idea what it is? The answer is, although we don't know what he is, but we do know what he does. And we acknowledge him by what he does. So we could say about God, he is a creator. He is a king. He acts like a loving father. Right? Now all these descriptions are not what he is, but it's what he does. He creates. He rules. He fathers. And we know God by what he does, and we relate to him by what he does. And we can have all kinds of descriptions of quote-unquote the God personality by seeing what he does. And how do we know what he does? Well, you look at what he does in the world. Look what it says in the Torah what he does. So we can know what he does, even though we don't know what he is. Point number one. Very important. But more than that, now that we are in God's image, what does it mean that we are in his image? Meaning to say that we are eminently capable of reflecting everything that he does. That is what it means to be in God's image. We learn from him, as the Talmud says, just as he is merciful, so you should be merciful. Just as he is compassionate, so you should be compassionate. This is what it means that God, man, is in the image of God. That man is designed to reflect all of God's actions, and we are in the image of his actions. And when we actualize our potential of being in the image of God, that means to try to reflect the midos, the characteristics that we see God exhibiting. We see that he exhibits kindness, he exhibits justice, and we're meant to exhibit those attributes, actualize the potential for ourselves to exhibit those attributes. And really, God built us to be a microcosm of everything that he does, not everything that he is. Okay? And therefore, when he does things, let's talk about when God does things. When God does something in this world, how much does he do it? What does that mean? How much does he do it? Well, does he do it with everything he's got? Does he let it rain with everything he's got? Does he bring life with everything he's got? Well, not possible, because God is infinite. And if the infinite would operate on an infinite scale, he'd blow us apart with his infiniteness, and we'd have no existence. Remember, an infinite being, there's no end to him, right? But there's a finite world that he created, and that itself is a whole discussion that I don't want to get into right now. But how does the infinite being relate to the finite world? So it's one of the miracles of creation that when God interacts with the finite world, he does so in a measured scale. Like he could shower us with a gazillion volts of kindness, but it would just blow us away. We get blown away by the infinite. So he measures it out as he sends it down into the world by a measure. In Hebrew, the Hebrew word for measurement is midah. Midah means a measurement, how you measure something. A divine attribute is called a midah or midos, which means measurements. And therefore, we talk about God's operating in this world with his midas chesed, for example, the attribute of kindness. It's a measure of kindness as opposed to the infinite kindness. Because if he gives us infinite kindness, it couldn't be contained in this finite world. So he doses it out in a finite way. And we're meant to reflect that. And therefore, we call character development as midos. Why? Because midos means measurements. Character traits of the image of God means that Hashem put a spark, so to speak, a taste of each one of those midos that he imposed upon himself into the construct of man. And therefore, man has the measure of the godly characteristics in himself. That's the way, and that's the image of God that we have. You with me so far? Okay. And therefore, the acts of God that are done on a human scale as opposed to the infinite scale is mystically called spheros. That magical word, the spheros. Right? Spheros are not what God is. Spheros are what God does. Spheros comes from the word spore, to count. And this is the units of divine character that God flows into this world as he interacts with the world. Okay? That's a little bit of the mysticism. And anything that happens in this world is because God is interacting with this world, and he's operating with some type of method of character of we can comprehend. Simply put, it hasn't rained in weeks. You pray to God for it to rain, and the rain comes down. What do you see? What do you see? Hello?
Rain.
But you see more than rain. You're seeing kindness. Isn't that kindness? Okay, now that's measured, right? So you're right. So if he brings down just enough to water the grass, and the grass is soaking it all up, and your cup is out there, and your cup is filled up, you take a drink, that's kindness. He's exhibiting kindness. What if he brings?
Burma.
What?
Burma. No, the cyclone in
Oh, a sign. What, he brings you a flood like in Noah's days? Then what are you seeing? Justice. But in a measured way. In a measured way, exactly. So the Torah teaches us, and mystically we're taught, many of the characteristics that God employs in dealing with his world. And therefore we understand a lot about God. There's a lot to know about God by what he does. And this book that we're going to learn, one chapter of this, is all based on this. It's all based on this. So when God revealed to Moshe his essence, and he started it with the 13 attributes of mercy, really when Moshe said, now listen, when Moshe said, God, show me who you are, what was Moshe really asking? Show me who I am. That's what he's really asking. Moshe knows the beginning of Genesis, right? He knows that man is created in God's image, right? So he's asking to see God. What's he really asking to see? He's saying, I want to see who I am. If I know what you do, then I know what I can do and what I am. That's what Moshe was asking. Moshe wants to know who and what man is. And when you're looking at God, as it were, and you're in God's image, then you're looking at yourself. Because Hashem is the role model which man is capable of emulating, since man is in God's image. And if God has 13 attributes of mercy, what do you think you have? 13 attributes of mercy. And that means, you know, all the Talmud says, that the act of the golden calf was so heinous on the part of the Jewish people. It's comparable, and when the rabbis say it, they're not mincing their words. They're saying it was comparable to, imagine, a wedding day. A bride at her wedding day. She's all dressed up. They're about to play Bilvavi. You know, you're about to walk down. And you're waiting in the wings. And meanwhile, it's an old flame from the past. Come here, let's have a little fun. And she excuses herself for about 15 minutes to have her fun. And then she's ready to go for a chuppah. And she's exposed for what she did. He says the Jewish people are like the kala, the bride, who fooled around under the chuppah. Because right at Sinai, they worshiped the golden calf. Okay, I want to ask you, ladies and gentlemen, if you were informed that your spouse was fooling around with somebody on your wedding day, no less, what would you do to them as a normal human being? You would take them and rip them apart. You'd have mercy, you wouldn't kill them. But you'd probably bludgeon them. You wouldn't want to speak, you wouldn't want to see them. Right? And after you beat them to a pulp, and the family says, what got into you? Of course, what do you answer? What do you want? I'm human. I'm human, I got feelings. Right? And at that point, when the Jewish people did that sin, and God says, well, really, you know, if I was a human being, that's what he was telling Moshe Rabbeinu, if I was a human being, I would wipe out the Jewish people. Because that's how a human being would react. If I was the human being king, now remember, what did God do for them? No small feat. There's 3 million of them, right? He made 10 plagues. He split the Sea of Reeds. He gave them manna in the desert. He gave them water in the desert. He gave them clouds of glory. He gave them everything they needed. He helped them develop into the people that they could be. It's like taking the beggar off the street. He did everything for them. He gave them the Torah at Sinai with the greatest fireworks display of spirituality in the history of the world. He did everything for them. He took a bunch of losers. They didn't even do they didn't look like Jews when they came out of Egypt. And he did everything for them. And Moshe says, can you wait 40 days for me to come back? I'll be back. Right? And he comes a couple minutes late. And they're ready. Poof, and they're dancing with the golden calf. So now, so she'll wipe them out. Right? God's saying to Moshe, I'm going to wipe them out. Not that God has petty feelings. God's saying, if I was like you, if I'm a king the way you would be a king, you want to wipe them out. So Moshe, do you have anything to say in their defense? So he does. So Hashem says, okay, I won't wipe him out. But there's going to be days in your life where you're going to meet people who are going to do this to you. There's going to be times in your life where, you know, you did so much for that person, or whatever the situation is. And there's going to be problems with your relationships. You're going to want to kill somebody, right? So God says, listen, I didn't wipe you guys out. I'm acting, as it were. I'm role-playing. And there's 13 attributes of mercy. If you will act out those 13 attributes of mercy, that will invoke a tremendous love between me and you. I won't wipe you out. But what God's really saying? God's saying that every human being possesses 13 attributes of mercy the way God possesses them. We'll learn what, and that's the whole point of this course, is to learn what the 13 attributes of mercy are in a real way. Not just the names, but what they really mean and how they manifest in behavior. And these are the very behaviors that God does on a regular basis. And that means we're capable of doing it, even in the worst situation that's comparable to the sin of the golden calf. Why? It's in your design, you're programmed that way. And the prophet Micha, he wrote an elaboration of those 13 principles. And that is exactly what we're going to be reading. Now, you might be familiar with these 13 principles when you go to do Tashlich on Rosh Hashanah. There's a little paragraph you read, and that's the paragraph. That's the paragraph. And the Cordovero takes that and explains mystically what it means. Did you have a hand? Question? Yeah?
Is there any alignment between these 13 principles, or 13 attributes of mercy, and the seven spirit?
Oh, yes. We will talk about that. If not this week, next week. It's on the list of things to talk about.
Is it both about character development? Not?
Yes. Yes, 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 but we're only going to touch a fraction of the spheres. We're only going to touch one sphere, as you'll see, but it's related to that. Okay, now it's very interesting. You know, Michelangelo, like to bring sources that are similar to my name. So, Michalowicz, Michelangelo, right? He says, that he was supposed to be a great artist and sculptor and all this stuff. So he was quoted saying, he never created anything that was beautiful, he said. He just finds the beauty in the stone and brings it out. You know, you take the stone, you chisel around it, but it's a beautiful stone. You just have to bring it out, which is really a fantastic vort, if you think about it. It's a fantastic vort, because what he's saying really is there, that the beautiful image was there. I just had to chisel all the garbage of the stone around it, and now there's a beautiful form that was there. But like he humbly or so wasn't taking credit to this. So Hashem says to Moshe that the Jewish people, and God is like the greatest Michelangelo, and the truth is the Jews can be the greatest Michelangelos. So Hashem said to Moshe, Jewish people have to find within themselves the 13 attributes of mercy and emulate Hashem, and we can be merciful in a godly fashion and not in a human fashion. And therefore, the most lame excuse that you ever can use in your life, and if you catch yourself saying it again, catch yourself and retract it. That excuse of saying, but I'm only human, is the worst excuse in the world. You know why? Because it's not exactly true. Because when you say I'm only human, you're using that as a basic aspect of your being limited. Of course, I'm only human, therefore I yelled at my wife, because I'm only human. And I'm only human, I didn't have compassion on this person, because I'm only human, because they didn't deserve it. Right? But the truth of the matter is, It's only human is true insofar that the human being can imitate God's ways. So when you say you're really being human, only human means only godly. Is that what it means? Right? Because we're not that limited as we think we are. When we say I'm only human, it means I have limitations. But really not, because you have the godly characteristics within yourself that you can bring out. So therefore, it's very incumbent upon everybody to examine these 13 attributes of God to know who we are. Isn't it that sad thing that you're going through most of your life and you don't even know what you're eminently capable of doing? God has put it in your spiritual DNA, many things, but one of these things is the 13 attributes of mercy. Can you imagine how your relationships would be better if you knew what they were and knew how to master them and knew how to use them in your life? How much better your relationships would be. But most of us don't even know we got them. We don't even know what we got inside of us. So if you know what you have inside of you, Then you at least know what you're shooting for, and then we could work on maybe accomplishing them. Right? And that is what God is saying, that if you're ever in trouble and you do something really bad, what did God say to Moshe? He said, what did he say? When you're ever in trouble, perform the 13 attributes of mercy, and I promise things are going to get better. Then Hashem is going to forgive us. So the question is, why? So the answer is, what's the problem? Whenever we do a sin, what's the real, deeper problem in every sin that we do? You know what the problem is when we do a sin? We violate our design. God designed us in a beautiful way, in a godly way. And every time we sin, we're violating that design. And that negatively impacts the relationship we can have with God. If we're able to act out those 13 attributes, what are we doing? We're getting back to our true design. We're becoming who we're supposed to be. And believe me, if you would be back to your true design, you wouldn't be doing any sins. You're coming to the core where anything, time to do something wrong, it's always based on a character flaw. There's no such thing as sinning with ideal character. So if you're sinning, that means there's a flaw in the design of your character because you haven't been taking care of it. And when we implement the 13 attributes of mercy, we're getting back to our design. And that's the ultimate teshuva that one can do. And God will keep us. And God will keep us. And that's why it's important to perform them. Not to say them, but to perform them. Especially for Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. Because that's the real big decisions are being made. So now with this, we now have a truer understanding of a definition that has been totally butchered through history. And that is the definition of spirituality. Right? Spirituality. Everybody now wants to be spiritual. You meet people, especially when they meet a rabbi, they always have to tell me how spiritual they are. And it's a little bit humorous what how they describe how they're spiritual. You know, like, oh yeah, I'm spiritual. You know, I like to sit on the grass and look at the flowers grow. You know, I'm spiritual. You know, I like to just, meditate, and I'm spiritual. Now, you know, I'm not saying there aren't spiritual people who don't meditate, and there aren't spiritual people who don't look at the grass, okay, or maybe smoke grass makes them more spiritual, I don't know. But if you really are hard-pressed, how do you define a spiritual person? Now, we would hope that we're all spiritual people, aren't we? How would you define it? In the real accurate description of spirituality, Jewish spirituality. Godlike is partially correct.
What tries to connect to God?
It's partially correct. Let me give you the precise definition, the one you have to memorize. You got to really, and this makes the whole difference in the world. The spiritual person is not this person who davens three times a day. It's not necessarily the person who gives tzedakah. Not necessarily the person who learns a lot of Gemara. Not necessarily. It's a person rising above their natural tendencies to act in a godly fashion. I'll say it again. That is the definition. That's everything in that definition. Rising above your natural tendencies. What's the natural tendency? I'm going to kill him. Because a human being is human, huh, right? We got to see which part of the human is doing that to you. You want to kill the person. You don't think they deserve your charity. You have a million one excuses not to be nice, right? That's your natural physical tendency. So a person who rises above their natural tendencies and to act in a godly fashion, that is a spiritual person. Because he is now accessing that part of the spiritual being that is within himself that is able to overcome the natural tendency within the person. And that's a spiritual person. Now, maybe one of the techniques you could do to become a spiritual is by meditating. Maybe meditation is one of those ways. But the bottom line to spirituality is, what's the bottom line? If you meditate for hours on end and you're still a rotten person, you know, you're not a spiritual person. Even if you have good excuses, Don't you love these people who have good reasons why they're doing what they're doing? It's justifiable reasons. You know, the guy just drove me nuts. You know, the guy's been picking on me, and I let him have it. And what do you expect? You know, that doesn't matter. That's not a spiritual person. The spiritual person goes beyond his natural tendencies and acts in a godly fashion, bringing out those godly qualities that you have. Okay? Yeah? You're the only guy asking questions today, Larry.
What's a religious person?
I don't know what a religious person is. I'm very bad at, you know, you have to define the term religious. And there's a lot, you know, religious person can be a Catholic person going to church because he's following his religion. Right, I don't like to work on that term. If I just like to say the following: if people ask me, "What kind of Jew are you?" We know you're not conservative, right? Well, big C conservative, right? We know you're not Reform. So you're Orthodox? Are you Hasidic? Are you Haredi? Right? So what are you? So the answer is, well, I'm a Torah Jew, and that's the only Jew there can be. There can be no other Jew. You're a Torah Jew. A Torah Jew does everything it says in the Torah. Right? There's no other definitions. Either you're a Torah Jew or you're not a Torah Jew. Is there any other definitions? Either you follow what it says in the Torah or you don't follow what it says in the Torah.
Spiritually.
Now, hopefully, a Torah Jew will live spiritually. You would hope that a Torah Jew would live spiritually. Right? So now, very good. Now we're going to get to something very unpolitically correct. Okay? So these 13 attributes, right, is a very special covenant between God and the Jews. It's in the Torah. God, it's like a covenant he made with Moshe. He says, you're ever in trouble, use the 13 attributes, things are going to be good. I promise, and you'll always survive with this. It's a covenant between us and God. Okay. However, question. Based on what Cordovero is saying, and this is really reaffirmed in Pirkei Avos, that says, mankind is precious because mankind is in the Tzelem Elohim, is in the image of God. So the question is, why are non-Jews not part of this covenant? If man is created in the image of God, and last time I checked, you don't have to be Jewish to be a human being, right? So they should have all these qualities that we've been talking about. They should be able to exhibit these qualities. They should be part of this covenant. And we don't find this to be part of the covenant. And this leads us to a very important thing that's going to be extremely unpolitically correct. And the answer is, no, they're not part of the covenant. And why are they not? Because there's two words that we have to define. In the Torah, there's two different Hebrew words. You're going to have to write these words down. Two different Hebrew words that are kind of almost synonymous for the English translation of the image of God. There's two Hebrew ways. The English word image is a terrible word. English words are terrible. Do not do justice to the Hebrew words. Just don't explain them. There's one word in Hebrew called tselem. Tselem Elohim. How do you translate into English? Image of God. In other terms, demus Elohim. Dmut. Demus Elohim. How does that translate to? Image of God. But the Torah uses them a few times in the book of Genesis. Now, if I had known we had such a scholarly crowd here, I would have brought the sheets with the verses and everything and show you copies how it's proved. But you'll trust me. Okay? There's two terms used when God describes mankind. He'll describe him either in the Tselem Elohim or the Demus Elohim. And you're saying, well, what's the difference? So I'm going to tell you a very way I was taught the difference between these two words and how this makes a big difference between the essential makeup of a non-Jew and a Jew. And also why God expects better behavior from Jews than non-Jews. Okay? And that's why you can't fall back on the excuse when you see the non-Jews behave one way and God expects you to behave another way. You know why? Because you're not, all men were not created equal. They weren't. And the difference is in Tselem and Demus. And let me explain. There's two terms, Tselem and Demus. Let's think of two other English words. We're going to use the word imitation and model. And model, M-O-D-E-L, as in miniature model. Remember this stuff, Larry?
No.
Good. Good. So, how do you define an imitation? How do you define in English? How do you define an imitation? It's a copy of the real thing. It's a wannabe. Is it the real thing?
No.
Could it be? Oh, what?
A replica.
How about a perfect replica? Could be a perfect replica. Could it look exactly like the real thing? Could. What's the difference? Substance. Its form looks the same, but the substance is totally different. For example, I can make a soybean look like a steak. You could. It could look like a steak. I don't know if it'll taste like one, but right? Glass can look like a diamond. Formica instead of wood. Right? It looks exactly the same, but substantially different. That is one. That's imitation. Model may not be the same size, may even be much smaller, but think of the idea of a scale model. It could be exactly the same thing as the original, but it's scaled down. A model plane. You know, it says 1 to 600 dimensions. It's exactly the same thing as the big plane. It's just itty bitty. A model rocket. A model home. It could be it is a precise reproduction, but in miniature. Okay, got the two terms? This really is the difference between the Hebrew words selem and demus. Selem also a Hebrew, what's another word in selem? Selem, a picture. A picture, it's also a picture, same word. Picture, what's a picture? A picture, it looks just like a picture of the car. It's exactly like if I have a big, huge, right? What did you do 2 years ago, Larry? You had a bunch of pictures of my face. You put on paper with people's faces, right? Looks exactly like my face, but it ain't my face. I mean, it's exactly, it's a picture. A picture is not my face, but it looks like my face, but it's not my face. Tell them, it's like a picture. It's an imitation, right? So, the Miller's analogy we're going to go with today is, selam is to demus, like imitation is to model. Selam is to demus, as imitation is to model. So now let's talk about this in terms of the creation of the human body. Okay? We have within ourselves, there's two descriptions of the creation of man. One is the creation of the body, and one is the creation of the soul. And we'll see that the body really is what we're going to call the imitation of God, and the soul is like the mini model. Okay? The body of man looks like the way that man would perceive God. And that means that man, he looks like an imitation of God. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. You're wondering, how could that be? I'll explain in a minute. The soul, on the other part, that really is quote-unquote the part of Hashem. And that's really the mini-model. And first man had both. There's a description of the Torah of the creation of the physical man. And that's the tselem. That's the image. That's the picture. That's the imitation. And then we got the demus, which is really the soul, and that's the mini model. And had first man not sinned, he would have perfected both dimensions. But since he sinned, he messed up. And then the Torah clearly shows us how only certain people had tselem. Most people just had tselem. And some had a tselem and a demus. I can prove to you from the sources in the text. I don't have time to bore you with that right now. But it's clear, and the Zohar says it emphatically, that most human beings only have tselem. And rare human beings have tselem and demus. Now you're wondering, what in the world does this mean? It's all going to be clear in a minute. Just hang on. Most human beings are the non-Jews of the world. And if you look through the book of Genesis, everyone had tselem. Just the imitation. Only one son of Adam, Chase, and only one son for 20 generations had the miniature model as well. And they all perverted it. And the only one, the last person in the world, the Torah says it clearly, the last person in the world who had both Selim and Demus was Abraham. And if he would have lost it, that would have been it. No more demus for mankind. Baruch Hashem, he did okay. And he preserved it and he developed it. And from him comes Jews who have tselem and demus. Okay, now what do I mean when I'm saying all this and what's going on over here? Well, the non-Jew has a body, and the non-Jew is able to imitate God. And that's his job in this world, is to imitate God. Meaning to say, if you look at a non-Jew, and a non-Jew is a good non-Jew, and he does his seven Noahide laws, you could look at that non-Jew, and you could see an imitation of God. And the non-Jew gets a good yashar koach, did a very nice job. Hashem's very happy with you. You are a loyal subject in his realm. And when he leaves this world, he will be rewarded for God for imitating God. It's very nice. But that's all he can do. That's all they can do. The best non-Jew, that's the best they can do. On the other hand, a Jew who has this demus as well is able to not only imitate, he's able to be a model, mamish, a model, a miniature model of God. And there's many sources that tell us this, that as the same source that says that man is beloved and he's an image of God, but the Jewish people are more beloved because we're called children of God. Now, what's going on over here? What's going on is, and there's another question that I have to ask, and with this we'll answer and everything will become very clear. There's another mitzvah in the Torah. Of the 630 mitzvahs, one is called the halachta bidrachav. You should go in God's ways. It's one of the 630 mitzvahs. And it means, just like God clothes the unclothed, you should clothe them. Just like God visits the sick, you should visit them. Just like God buries the dead, you should bury them. And that's what the rabbis say. That's the mitzvah of going in God's ways. So the question is, it sounds a lot like acts of kindness to me. It sounds like charity to me, which is already a mitzvah in the Torah. So why don't you need another mitzvah to repeat the mitzvah already there? And here's the answer, and this is the critical point. When a person does an act of kindness, you can do it in two ways. You can do it in two ways. One way you could do is you say, "Oy, Nebuch, the guy's in the hospital. Oy, I feel so sorry for him. You never know, maybe one day I'll be in the hospital. I might need help. You know what? Somebody should see him. Okay, I'll see him. I'll do a kindness." Right? He's doing a kindness. "Oy, the guy looks so down and out. I will give him charity." He's giving charity. He's doing the act of giving charity. There's a higher level where you don't do charity. You are what we call a ba'al chesed, a master of kindness, a person from whom kindness flows. It's just part of your essence. It's part of your being. I don't need to calculate 10 times over, should I or shouldn't I? It's a pain, it's a hassle, it's a this and that. I'm doing it. You have a person who does kindness, and you have a person who is kind. Do you hear there's a difference? The person who does kindness probably comes home after all day and fetches his spouse. "Boy, man, it was a tough day today. I had to do so many things. I had to help this guy, to help that guy, to help that guy." He's miserable because he's being so kind. Right? The other guy comes and says, "What a great day! I did 28 acts of kindness." You know why? Because he ain't doing acts of kindness. He is kind. It's his personality. That's who he is. Who's happier? The one who is, not the one who does. Right? So the rabbis say, this is the difference between an imitation and a mini model. The imitation, right, is monkey see, monkey do. Well, God is kind. Okay, I can copy God. But it's only external, and it's only skin deep. But deep, deep inside, the person doesn't really, it's not really what he's all about. And therefore, whenever there's an excuse not to be kind, here's where the difference comes now. You'll see in a second. There's the other being, that's the imitation. Then there's the mini model. The mini model is kind just the same way God is kind. So let's say a simple type of example, which we'll develop more in a few weeks. Let's say Mr. A and Mr. B do the exact same kindness to Mr. C and Mr. D. Okay? Now, Mr. A does the kindness to Mr. C, and then a few hours later, Mr. C insults Mr. A. Okay? On the other hand, Mr. B, I'm losing track of my numbers now, Mr. B and Mr. D does to Mr. D a kindness, and Mr. D insults him too. Mr. A and Mr. B go home to their wives. What is Mr. A saying? A's the guy, I forgot to tell you one more thing. He says, Mr. A says, you know, I can't believe it. You know what I did for this guy? You know what I did? You know how much kindness I did for him in the last 3 weeks? Every day I went to the hospital for him. Every day this or this. And you know what? He called me an idiot. You know? I regret ever having done that. And next time, I ain't going to him. Now, what can we say about this person? Did he do kindness? He was imitating kindness. But it's not him. It's not him. And as soon as now he's got an excuse not to do it, he's not going to do it. The other guy says, you know, I've been doing this guy so much kindness, and I feel so sorry for him that he just doesn't know how to appreciate the things that are done. But you know what? I'm really glad that I'm even kind of happy he insulted me, because I don't regret doing it, because I know I did an amazing thing and I felt good doing it the whole time, and my feelings haven't changed no matter what he has to say. Now, that's probably a good description of Mary Poppins, you know, but or someone with the Demus Elohim, somebody who essentially loves to be kind, is kind. If you are kind, the external situations aren't going to change your feelings about what you've done. And that's the difference between someone who imitates kindness and someone who is kind. So of course the Torah says you have to do acts of kindness. Of course you have to visit the sick. Of course you have to bury the dead. Of course you have to give clothes to those who don't have. But that's not enough. As a Jew, there's an extra mitzvah of a halachta bidracha. You got to go in God's ways. Meaning to say, you got to do it the same way God would do it. Don't just imitate him. You got to do it the exact same way God would do it. And when God does something, he doesn't do it because, you know, I'm in the mood. Guys, I'm in a good mood today. I'm going to bring rain to the world. You know, I'm really happy that the Canadians, they won the Stanley Cup, so I'm going to give Canada a lot of rain. Because I'm in a good. God doesn't work with moods. He is. He is kind. That's his being. That's his character. And therefore, it doesn't matter what other people are doing. He is kind. Now, when it's not appropriate to be kind, he won't be kind. But if it's appropriate, even though the other person's not appreciative, he's still going to be kind. Because he is kind. So now, there's different human beings in the world. Your regular, nice, non-Jewish person in the world was only endowed with the ability to imitate God's actions. He's in the Tzel of Elohim. He can imitate God's actions. That's about it. And it's wonderful. And if you look at him, it's a nice picture of, it's a godly act. It looks like something God would do. But when push comes to shove, he may back out. When the going gets tough, he could back out, and all of a sudden he changes his mind, and then it's too hard, and he regrets doing it, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, he was imitating, but it wasn't who he is. A Jew is commanded to develop more, because we have more inside of ourselves. We have this incredible soul that's eons beyond the non-Jewish soul. No offense to the non-Jews of the world. That's the choices they made long ago, and that's what they're stuck with. But the soul that we have is so much more of godliness that produces a concept of demus, which means we're mamish, a mini model of God. That soul we have from God, that part of God on high, that's an infinitely incredible source of character, of actions. We can literally copy, not just copy, model the exact behavior, because we have the same essence of God's way of doing things and why he does it. We have that same feeling that he has. And that's why a Jew has in his ability to do more. The non-Jews only have 7 Noahide laws. It only obligates them what not to do. Don't destroy society. But a Jew who is literally part of God's essence, we have to be like God, and therefore our acts are not just acts that imitate, that copy, but they are exactly a model. He's a diamond, we're a small diamond. We're not cubic zirconia. And our actions have to be exactly those actions, the way God would do it exactly. Okay? This is what it means to have the demus Elohim. So first man didn't develop it properly. Avraham had it, and Avram was able to do the actions and be the actions and be the master of that feeling that's necessary to make the action genuine and sincere and won't change because of external factors. Okay? You know, it's like that, the issue that the Rambam had with the philosophers. And the philosophers basically said, you know, a human being isn't anything more than a sophisticated animal. And they want to prove it to the Rambam. So they trained a cat. They train a cat. They say, we can make a cat be just like a human being. And Rambam says, not possible. So, oh, yes, we can. So they got a cat trainer, and they got from the that knew all the sophisticated things, Emily Post School of Cat Training. And they taught the cat mamish everything. So came the final test. They're going to a beautiful dining room, and the Rambam's there, and the other guys, the philosophers there, say, here, we're bringing the cat. And the cat's in his tuxedo, and he's ambling up to the table, and mamish, the cat puts the napkin out, everything. He's using the left fork and the right thing. Everything gets mamish, and the Rambam is not worried at all. He's not even sweating. And they're saying, why is that? And the cat says, can you pass me the salt, please, the face, whatever. The whole routine. Rambam says, okay, you finished? Says, yeah, we're finished. We proved it. Just one second. Ram takes a little mouse out. Little mouse. Rah! And his lips are all tearing. He's crazy jumping around. And he comes back with a little rat in his mouth. Ram says he could dress him up like a cat. But he's like a human being, but he's still a cat. In other words, he can imitate, but it's not him. It's not him. The non-Jew can imitate God. Can imitate God. But when push comes to shove, the lack of godliness is going to come out. The Jew, on the other hand, can develop to the point where he is the spiritual being, that he goes beyond the natural tendencies and acts in a divine manner in all situations in life. And this is the whole point of Kurdever's book, that a Jew is totally different than anyone else. We got to understand that. We have to believe this. It's in our writings. It's in our teachings. Everything in the Torah talks about this. We don't mean chas v'shalom to say that non-Jews are not nice people and that they're bad. You have non-Jews who develop their potentials. We have non-Jews who don't develop their potentials. We have Jews who develop their potentials. We have Jews who don't develop their potentials. And the truth is, a Jew who does not develop his potential usually is worse than a non-Jew who does not develop his potentials. But at the end of the day, when you're going to take the MVPs of the Jews versus the non-Jews, you can't compare them. They are two different beings on the planet. One is capable of so much, the other is capable of so much more. And therefore, what's hard for us to believe is that although we look the same, we think we can't act any better than they act. And therefore, all the things that they show us from their world, whether it's in the advertising industry or what's on the television or on the computer, those are acts of people who are only blessed with tzelem. And with tzelem, you can only go so far. And you can get editorials from the most sophisticated and articulate and wonderful non-Jews, can only go so far. And that's why you could have a world where the non-Jewish world can watch 6 million Jews get killed, and they can wine and dine and have no problems hearing that Jews are getting murdered, or anywhere else in the world for that matter, while a Jewish neshama is different. And even though you hear about how husbands beat their wives, and people have troubles with relationships, and people are getting divorced, and now it is very normal to get divorced, And whoever's going to get married today, 3 out of 4 are going to be divorced. Because you're dealing with people who only have a tzelem, who can imitate, but when life becomes stressful and pressurized, then they don't know how to handle it. And then the cat comes out of everybody, and they can't get married. They can't stay married to each other. And the Jews figure, well, I guess we can't be any different. The answer is, of course you can be different. You're made different. You've got the 13 attributes of mercy. The non-Jews don't have the 13 attributes of mercy. And since we have the 3 attributes of mercy, we can act in a godly way. And that's what Cordovero is going to teach us. He's going to teach us these. The book is based on that premise. Since we are his miniature model, So the acts that we find by God are only acts, not only acts we must do, but we must be those beings. I'll tell you one quick story. This is one example. There's millions of this. There was one great rabbi in Jerusalem. He ran a free loan fund. He ran a free loan fund for poor Jews in Jerusalem. And, you know, there are certain rules to the free loan fund. You had a co-signer, and he'd give you some money, and then, you know, only so much money could they lend you, and you couldn't borrow that, you know, and you had to pay back before you can borrow again. Anyway, comes a Friday afternoon, and usually the free loan society was finished by early Friday morning. There was no money left to give out after that. Everybody borrowed. So somebody comes over to the guy in charge, the rabbi in charge of free loan society. He says, I need some money. And the rabbi says, weren't you here yesterday? I was here yesterday. But I need some money. So I checked some. Well, we already lent you to the limit. And you know the rule we have limited money. We can't lend you any more till you pay back. So I told you I need it, and if I need it, I need it. Wham! And he slaps him right in the face. The guy says, just 1 minute. He goes downstairs. And other people were watching. They're ready to kill this guy. Because the guy in charge was a nice little quiet guy. And he goes downstairs, he makes some arrangements, that he borrows something. They said he brings him the money and sends him away. And the people looking said, hey, why'd you do that? The guy was terrible. You should have slugged him back. You should have just ignored. He said, listen, I know this guy. He's normally a very nice guy. But if it got to the point that he slapped me, he must be in big trouble. Okay, now I want to know how many of us in this room would have given him any money. Let's be honest. Be really honest. It's Erev Shabbos also, remember. Okay? So that's an example. And if we would have ignored him, maybe we would have ignored him. That would have probably been our best. Some of us may have slapped him back. Some may have insulted him. Most would probably have ignored him. But the other one said, you know what? God wouldn't ignore him. That's a spiritual person. So hopefully, next week we will begin with concrete examples of how to act in a godly fashion. And if we can do that, then Baruch Hashem, our relationships will improve. Thank you so much.